Okay, it's 12 o'clock, and our last argument that we'll be hearing today is Doe versus Biden, appeal number 22-1197. Mr. Mack?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've reserved 5 minutes, correct?
Correct.
Okay, please begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Magg. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case. This case has to do with the reclassification of bump stocks from an unregulated item into machine guns under the National Firearms Act, under the Gun Control Act. I know this is not the first such case that this court has heard. I know other such similar types of cases have been heard around the country. But this one is different, as I think even the defendant will concede. In this case, we're not challenging the reclassification itself. For purposes of this case, we concede, fine, the bump stock's a machine gun. Reasonable question whether it is, but for purposes of this case, we concede it. According to the ATF's defendant's own figures in the rule that is subject to this appeal, there are about 500,000 of these bump stocks, i.e. unregistered machine guns, floating around the country. According to the ATF's own figures, a fraction of 1% of less than 1% of those have been turned in. So there are still floating around the country 500,000 unregistered machine guns, according to the defendants in this case. We contend that contrary to the requirement that these items be destroyed or surrendered, which apparently has flopped in the real world with the American populace, that the defendants abused their discretion, acted arbitrarily, capriciously in determining that they lacked the authority to implement an amnesty period under the National Firearms Act. Under the National Firearms Act, there is a provision, it's not codified, but it is contained in there. The originally Secretary of the Treasury, now the Attorney General, so one of the defendants in this case, has the authority, in the interests of the Act being the National Firearms Act, which of course regulates machine guns, among other things, to implement a period of amnesty not to exceed 90 days in any particular case, and upon publication of his intention to do so in the Federal Register, to have unlimited, unfettered amnesties, again, not longer than 90 days in any individual amnesty, with immunity from liability to register firearms such as unregistered machine guns.
We're talking about the 1968 Act, right?
The 1968 Act, yes.
And how do we know that the scope of the amnesty as contemplated in that 68 Act goes so far as to give the Secretary of Treasury, and now AG, the discretion to authorize an unlawful firearm into becoming now a lawful one, as opposed to the amnesty scope really being directed to when there has been a failure to timely pay a tax or apply for a registration or to do the registration. And so why isn't it more of a registration tax-centric form of amnesty as opposed to this broader version that you're contemplating, which is something that's already been ruled by Congress to be criminal? The AG, the executive branch, can now override that choice and make it legal.
You have to understand the original mechanism of the original 1934 National Firearms Act that was triggered the amendments in 1968. Under the original 34 Act, declared unconstitutional in Haney's v. U.S. by the Supreme Court in 1968 under the Fifth Amendment, a possessor of an illegal unregistered firearm, term of art, machine gun, was required to fill out a form and register it with the collector of internal revenue and thus incriminate himself for possessing an unregistered firearm. to alleviate that problem, among others, and in 1968, Congress amended the statute, the 1968 Act, and took away the ability for mere possessors of unlawful firearms, unregistered machine guns, things brought back from World War II, Korea, Vietnam Wars, that were never registered or couldn't have been registered, to be registered. And to alleviate the practical problem by the Haney's decision saying that the prior act was unconstitutional under Fifth Amendment, they held a 30-day amnesty, much like it is set forth in the statute that the Attorney General now has the authority to enact even today.
Are you talking about the buyer under the authority of provision?
No, I'm talking about in 1968, November of 1968, the Internal Revenue Service allowed a 30-day period in 1968 by under express act of Congress as part of the amendments to register anything and everything, legal, illegal, serial numbers marked off, guns in the possession of felons, guns that were already registered that didn't need to, no questions asked. And complete immunity, which is still in the statute, was afforded for that 30-day, what on the form says, special grace period, which really wasn't an amnesty. It really was an initial registration period because the original act was declared unconstitutional. But it is our contention that things like that is the purpose of Section 209C, I believe it is, that's still contained in the National Firearms Act, that in the interest of the National Firearms Act, which, since 1934, Congress has stated, we want all machine guns registered in a central database, first with the Collector of Internal Revenue, now with the Attorney General, so that we, the federal government, can keep track of them. That's the stated intent of Congress. That is the purpose of the amnesty provision. When something happens, be it a reclassification of something from unregistered to a machine gun, or a war where soldiers bring back war trophies, which happened World War II, Korea, Vietnam, or just the passage of time where things aren't kept up, to correct the records and get the registry state correct and to bring into the fold, as it were, that which is technically illegal and that there is no other mechanism to register. If Your Honor found an unregistered machine gun or even a registered machine gun in your front lawn, there is no mechanism, absent an amnesty, for you to go to the ATF and register that. None. It doesn't exist.
Is your idea that the AG can create such an amnesty and then the holder of a machine gun, a bump stock machine gun, can then register and then they lawfully possess that machine gun going forward thereafter?
Correct.
No risk of criminal liability?
Because the statute, the National Firearms Act, says the registration is... You have, it's unclear whether it's use immunity or transactional immunity, but yes.
Okay. There's a lot of cases, I think, that say the whole purpose here was to freeze the limit or the number of machine guns at the 1986, I think, levels.
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that there are no reported cases out there construing the breadth of the amnesty power in this statute. It's, frankly, other than this case, as near as I can tell, never been adjudicated. There are some cases out there where people try to apply to make and transfer new post-86 machine guns under the 1934 or 1968 regime after 1968 that have held, as Your Honor has stated.
Just so I understand your theory, as I understand it, the district court was focused on Section 922-0.
Yes.
And looking at that one provision in there that's an exception to making machine guns off unlawful route.
There are two exceptions.
The one they were focused on was buyer under the authority of the United States or a state.
Correct.
And then concluded that that exception doesn't apply to you or to your client and their otherwise unlawful machine gun. Is your amnesty theory, which is, comes from the 68 Act, a separate theory from the buyer under the authority of provision under 922, or are they somehow two pieces of the same theory?
I think that the court has an obligation to construe the two statutes on the same general topic in harmony. And therefore, I think that they work together. And I think if you look at the language of both...
I guess the question I have is, what if we agree with the district court about the interpretation of the exception in Section 922, or both exceptions?
Well,
so does that end the case?
No, because there are alternative arguments, such as my client being a police officer and authorized under state law as a police officer to have a machine gun. Therefore, he should be able to register it. Or we're also claiming that 18 U.S.C. 922-0 is itself unconstitutional. Because, I mean, for instance, contrary to the Wickard-Filburg, Reich-Ashcroft type case law, where Congress sought to regulate an entire field of fungible items.
Okay, I understand we're talking about Commerce Clause right now, but getting back to my question.
Sure.
And interpreting 922.
Yes.
And the two exceptions. If we were to hypothetically agree with the district court's interpretation of 922, does that end the argument you have on the amnesty question?
No, because if 922-0 is unconstitutional,
okay,
then we're right back to the amnesty question.
Okay, let's say the Commerce Clause thing, we also affirm the district court on, and also affirm that it's not a tax, and also follow McCutcheon that, you know...
Yeah, if you don't overrule yourself.
Which we're bound to. To what extent is there anything lurking still with regards to your amnesty theory?
If you find against me on every argument I have related to 922-0 and you fail to overrule McCutcheon, as I understand the panel is bound to, then that's the end of my case.
Okay.
But then my argument
is... your amnesty hook is through the exception set forth in Section 922.
Is the amnesty hook in the exception to 922-0 or that 922-0 is a nullity?
Why does still being an officer mean he can register a machine gun that he owns as a private individual?
Because that's what the statute says. It says merely under the authority. It doesn't say if a machine gun registered to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department or a machine gun registered to the U.S. Marshals Service.
So then my follow-up is, how do you interpret the phrase under the authority?
Under the authority, as near as I can tell, was first used by Marbury versus Madison by the Supreme Court back 200-something years ago to essentially mean the basis of an authority to act. The Supreme Court more recently construing authority to act when New Jersey repealed its gambling law, horse race law, said that repealing a prohibition or a statute allowing something is authority to act. Therefore, it is our contention that if there is a statute either authorizing it or a statute that previously repealed it has been, or previously prohibited has been repealed, that is authority to act. Since there is a provision in the National Firearms Act allowing the amnesty, it is our provision that is authority to act, and therefore authority under 18 U.S.C. 922-0.
You're into your rebuttal. Do you want to save it?
I would like to, yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's hear from the government.
Okay, Mr. Hinchelwood?
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. It sounds like the Court has a sound handle on the issues here. I would start by just focusing briefly on the text of the amnesty provision, and I think my colleague at the very end of his presentation sort of explained his theory, at least as we've understood it, which is that the amnesty, enacting an amnesty provision, or creating an amnesty under Section 207D of the Gun Control Act, would somehow automatically also confer the authority of the United States under 922-01A. But we know that can't be true for several reasons. One is that, of course, as a textual matter, we know that registration does not confer the authority of the United States because the other exception in 922 is people who lawfully have registered, possess lawfully registered and transferred weapons, and those people don't have the authority of the United States. They possess their weapons under the authority of the grandfather provision within 922.
But my understanding from the other side is that they understand the scope of the amnesty provision to be something broader than just forgiveness over failure to register. It's like making, granting someone the authority to hold and possess an otherwise unlawful firearm.
Your Honor, I don't see how they get that out of the text of Section 207D itself, out of the amnesty provision, especially given the history that my colleague was reciting. I mean, at the time, of course, in 1968, it was lawful to possess a lawfully registered machine gun, and the whole purpose of the amendments to the National Firearms Act was to address registration and, as you pointed out, taxation.
Did your brief do a discussion of Section 207D and what 207D encompasses and does not encompass with the amnesty provision?
I mean, I believe we said that, you know, in that Section 207D allows for, you know, the lawful registration of weapons that could lawfully be possessed. But of course, machine guns no longer fall into that category. They did in 1968, but that's not true after 1986. You know, you cannot lawfully possess a machine gun if it wasn't already lawfully possessed as of May 19th, 1986.
And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how do we know that 207D is limited to granting amnesty for registering and only lawful weapons as opposed to any firearm?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of things. One is that, of course, Section 207D talks about, you know, the purposes of this title, meaning Title II of the Gun Control Act, which, of course, addresses only registration of lawfully possessable weapons and the associated taxes. It's a reenactment of the National Firearms Act with amendments designed to address not only the Fifth Amendment concerns the Supreme Court identified, but some other issues as well. So you're already talking about a registration and taxation scheme. You're not talking about, oh, here's a provision that allows you to sort of be sort of exempt you from all gun laws, past, present, and future. I mean, it's tied to the statutory context in which it's enacted. And then when Congress comes along, you know, 18 years later, and says specifically, look, there's going to be no more public possession of new machine guns. We're going to outlaw that. And we're going to create these exceptions. We're going to allow grandfathering of existing registered weapons, you know, and permit those to continue to be lawfully possessed. That's quite different from saying, oh, and by the way, we can simply, you know, eliminate all of that, all those restrictions by, you know, by the simple act of registration, right? Which is essentially what Mr. Doe's argument here.
Well, I guess they're also heavily leaning into this buyer under the authority of language in 922. And you know, if assuming that I didn't know anything about this case and I was just looking at this statute, it does feel a bit ambiguous because there are two different exceptions within this provision. Any machine gun possessed by the United States or any machine gun possessed under the authority of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we absolutely know that under the authority of has to mean something different than possession by the United States. So what is that alternate context besides United States possessed machine guns that this provision provides an exception to?
Well, Your Honor, I think, you know, what sort of by the United States versus under the authority of the United States, that provision may encompass, for example, when, you know, a member of the military has the weapon, sort of they are possessing the weapon, but they're doing so under the authority of the United States. But whatever the scope of, you
know,
those...
Couldn't that be by the United States then, if it's by someone, a member of the military in his or her official capacity?
You know, whether you sort of read... Which sort of prong you read that to fall under, I don't think really makes a difference here, where the relevant question is whether registration alone, which is what the amnesty would permit, would in fact permit, you know, somehow confer the authority of the United States. And we know textually just from 922O that that's not true, and it also just follows from thinking about the basic premises of what Congress was doing in 922O. You know, as the Seventh Circuit pointed out in Kenney, the whole purpose here is to freeze.
So are you saying that maybe... If we were to write an opinion, we shouldn't try to delve into the intricacies of what is the scope of under the authority of. All we need to say is just, well, just based on the overall purpose and context and history of this statute, it couldn't possibly be something that encompasses what Mr. Doe wants.
Well, I don't think it's just...
I mean, that's a little bit of an unsatisfactory statutory interpretation.
Well, Your Honor, again, I don't think it's just the purpose, context, and history. I mean, just looking at the relationship between the two exceptions themselves, you know, itself demonstrates textually that registration alone is not enough. And that's why, for example, the Seventh Circuit, when it was presented with this, with a similar question in Ross, right, we had an individual who said, hey, you know, I can't be prosecuted, you know, Congress can't create two separate offenses, one for, you know, possession of an unregistered weapon and also then ban me from possessing the weapon, you know, full stop in 922-0. And the Seventh Circuit said, no, those are two separate offenses. Those are two separate problems, separate types of conduct. And Congress can, of course, you know, sort of have both sort of limitations in place. But what that means necessarily is that when you have this later enacted statute that sort of specifies, look, we're no longer going to permit lawful commerce in machine guns that aren't, you know, already sort of in the marketplace, that Congress is telling you that that's exactly what it wants to do, right? That it wants to, you know, freeze that the number of those weapons in private hands at that time.
So what's the single sentence definition for buyer under the authority of?
Your Honor, an individual who, you know, when a weapon is possessed, you know, buyer under the authority of the United States, state local law enforcement, you know, for the purpose, you know, for official use, you know, as part of their, you know, sort of official duties. That is, you know, I think generally how that term has been understood. That's how it's been consistently interpreted by the courts that have looked at it. You know, the Tenth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, the cases we cited.
Those cases basically defer to the ATF regulation, right?
I'm not sure that they. I think they discussed the fact that ATF had an existing regulation at that time, but I'm not sure that any deference is necessarily required. And again, you know, the exact contours of what we count as the authority of the United States, buyer under, nothing in this case, I think, turns on, you know, sort of the finer points of what that would or would not encompass.
The Appellant's counsel says there are no circuit cases, at least, that interpret the breadth of this amnesty and actually address his particular argument. Does the government agree with that?
I'm not aware of any cases that address the amnesty provision other than this one. I mean, certainly cases have addressed the scope of 922-0, you know, Farmer from the 11th Circuit and Warner from the 10th, and have, you know, rejected the kinds of arguments that he's pressing here. But as to the amnesty provision itself, I'm not aware of cases interpreting that.
And he made reference to Mr. Doe evidently was or is some sort of law enforcement officer. Do we have anything in the record on that? Is that an issue that we need to confront?
I don't think it's an issue you need to confront because, I mean, if he is authorized by a, you know, law enforcement agency to, you know, use a machine gun in connection with his official duties, then there's nothing in the rule or regulation that would, you know, affect his ability to do that.
And the government's not here to argue that he can't do that, right?
Right. I mean, I think the reason it doesn't really matter one way or the other. I will say, just as a factual matter, it's not at all clear from the record that Mr. Doe actually is a police officer. At summary judgment, he submitted an affidavit that does not say he's a police officer. It says he was at the time the case was filed, and that he hoped to again, or hoped to soon, have the authority to possess a machine gun pursuant to sort of official duties, but at least at the time of summary judgment, that's his affidavit is at pages 686 and 87 of the appendix, doesn't actually say that he is currently a police officer. But again, it doesn't matter for purposes of this case. And if there are no further questions, we're happy to rest on our brief.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Magg, you still have a little time left.
Thank you, Ron.
Is Mr. Doe a police officer today?
Today, yes. At the time the case was filed, yes. There was a period in between where he was between departments. Oh. Hence the phrasing of the affidavit.
Okay.
Do we have the affidavit? Is that in the appendix?
The affidavit is in the record. The affidavit will say that at the time the case was filed, he was a high-ranking officer. It doesn't reference the fact that he's since been reemployed. Like I said, he was changing jobs at that exact moment. But I think the relevant time period is the date it was filed. The case was filed because we're concerned about what the ATF, the defendants, did in their ruling in 2018, 2019, not at some intervening time period after the fact.
So he could then ostensibly go to his department, his new department, and see if they would authorize his possession of this machine gun.
And if they don't, and if he had registered it, then he could have sold it on the open commercial market to a person qualified to take it, such as another department, a licensed dealer, or whoever is allowed to possess such items, if it were registered. Being unregistered is contraband.
Okay. Any final thoughts?
I appear to be out of time. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you. The case is submitted, and that concludes today's arguments.